This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. Did you know that using DistroKid's Teams function, you can route any percentage of your track earning to a band member or collaborator? This is a free feature for all DistroKid members. Take advantage of this awesome function and so many more using our DistroKid discount link, distrokid.com/VIP/MPW.
What am I saying?
This is MPW,
the podcast with your host,
Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Naomi McCarthy is the Senior Campaigns and Policy Officer for the Independent Society of Musicians, or ISM. She's responsible for developing ISM's policy and campaign strategies in the areas of EDI, international touring, and music education. She has worked on various ISM reports, including Dignity at Work 2, and in her spare time plays the violin and piano. Hello, Naomi. It's so great to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's lovely to have you. So before we get into our topic of looking at ISM's Dignity at Work study, I'd love to learn a little bit more about you. So where did your career start for you and how did you get to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I kind of took a slightly strange route. I've always worked in the music industry, but I actually started out as a music journalist working on music magazines. So in the early part of my career, I was working for the Strad magazine and became the editor of that. Had a great time doing that, but then decided it was time to move on. And I moved sort of sideways into specialist violin auctioneering. And that came about because I was asked... Yes, it was a real sidestep. I was asked to set up the London office of Teresio Auctions, and they're a specialist auctioneer of fine violins, and they're an American company, so they were expanding into Europe. So I set up the office for them and then sort of ran their auctions. And a real highlight of that was when we auctioned the Leta Blunt Stradivari violin, which was for the Nippon Foundation on behalf of the tsunami victims. Oh. This is back in 2011, yeah. And that was an amazing experience. And then it was from sort of 2016. And obviously we had the EU referendum in 2016 and the vote to leave the EU. And I became a lot more kind of politically motivated at that point. Started doing quite a lot of kind of volunteering politically, knocking on doors, that kind of thing. Yeah, and I decided that was kind of where my passion really lay, trying to make a difference to people's lives and sort of helping. And so when this job came up at the ISM doing lobbying on behalf of musicians, that was kind of like the perfect combination of where my experience lay and where my passions lay. So now I basically lobby on behalf of musicians and the whole music industry, which is incredibly stimulating, exciting, and it's a great thing to be doing.
That's amazing. And it's so strange, isn't it? I guess maybe you wouldn't have thought that this would be what you were doing back when you started the career, and it's sort of one thing led to another and you found the thing that you really love.
Yes, exactly. I think it does, it is amazing. The music industry is a great place to work. And what I love about it is there are so many different things that you can do. And I feel I've kind of found my home in a way now doing what I'm doing at the moment.
That's great. And we actually recently did a post about this on social media about the fact that there are so many avenues in the music industry that no one knows about. And we're still sort of taught only the traditional sort of roles that there are in the music industry, like a musician or a singer or something like that. But it's great to know that there are so many other avenues.
Absolutely.
So coming to a bit of time travel, can you tell me what is one event in your life that you feel you have learnt the most from?
Well, I don't know. This is not exactly an event, so you can tell me if it doesn't count. But I have an autistic son, and having him has been the most, it's taught me the most about life, I think, seeing life through another person's lens, someone who is neurodiverse. And has challenges socially, has taught me a huge amount. Obviously, you learn a lot being a mum anyway, but having a child who is different is yeah, it teaches you a lot about understanding how other people see the world, and a lot of patience and a lot of joy comes from it as well. So I would say I've learned most from him.
Oh, that definitely is a huge thing. And I'm sure we can't summarize all the learnings that you have in probably even an episode, but are there any particular things that stand out? I know you mentioned like patience and things, but that specifically you feel like you may see differently compared to other people who haven't been in the same shoes as you?
I think it's made me a lot more tolerant, I think, of other people, and understand that everybody does have their own challenges. And yeah, I think it's quite easy to be simplistic about parenting and sort of how other people operate. And I think it's just really broadened my horizons so much, having to learn how to parent differently. And you have all sorts of expectations, I think, about how it will be. And it never is, I think, how you might expect it. But having an autistic child really does put you on the spot and makes you realize that you have to really step outside your own shoes.
No, that's it's a great thing to mention, and something that I'm sure you would never really know what that's like unless you've been in that experience and been in your
shoes. Exactly, yeah.
And can you tell me what is one random fact about yourself that maybe not that many people in the industry know about you?
I suppose that I love running. It's probably something that people don't necessarily know about me. And it's something I came to. I wasn't particularly athletic sort of growing up. And it's something I came to sort of in adulthood. And now it's been sort of life changing, actually. I mean, it's not like I run particularly far or fast, but it is really important for me to get out and do that. I think it's both sort of a physical and a mental support. So, yes, I feel quite that feels like part of my identity now.
I love that. I love that. And for me as well, actually, running was never something that I used to do. And probably in the last maybe 4 years or so, I've started running as well. And it's just such an easy form of exercise because you don't need anything. You don't have to rely on anything other than potentially the weather. But I think anything like that brings activeness to your life is so great. So coming to the study that ISM has done on dignity at work, can you tell me how do musicians of different demographic groups, such as age, sexual orientation, race, disability, and experience, or how do they experience discrimination, and what specific challenges do they face in reporting these incidents?
Sure. Well, that's a good place to start. And I just wanted to just quickly introduce the report. So this is, as you say, our Dignity at Work 2 report. So it's our second one. We published it last year. And the reason we did it is because we'd first done a report in 2018, which was Dignity at Work 1. This was the first time we'd really looked into discrimination across the music industry. And it was quite a depressing report. It found so evidence of so much. So we were coming back to it and saying, has anything changed? Have things improved? And sadly, they haven't. So this time round, we found that 66% of musicians had experienced discrimination at work, and this had gone up from 47%. This is obviously people who are responding to our report. So yes, it's got worse. I mean, obviously, that's, you know, there could be reasons why that is. I mean, we've had the sort of the Me Too movement. Perhaps people are more encouraged to speak about it. But what we found was it's gone up since last time. So that's 66% saying that they've experienced it, and what we also found is that it's disproportionately worse for people for women, for starters, but also people in minority groups. So we found that 78% of discrimination was against women. 94% of Black, Asian and mixed or other ethnic groups reported that they had experienced discrimination, and 76% of people who have a disability. So I think the group that was worst effective overall was Black women. So if you're sort of part of two groups, if you like, or more, then you're much more likely to suffer discrimination. And also we found a lot of it is sexual harassment. So 58% of the discrimination reported overall fell into that category. So it was a pretty depressing picture overall of what's going on. And I think you asked about sort of specific challenges. I think the problem is that the music industry, it's really way behind other modern workplaces in how it handles discrimination. And that's partly how it operates. There's often, you know, no policies in place, no procedures for how you report discrimination. And we found that 75% of all respondents said that there was no way, that they didn't know who they would go to report an incident. So then how is that taken up? And it's just not. And I think also the nature of the industry, it sort of blurs the lines of when you're at work, so to speak. It's not a 9-to-5 job that you've got. So you might be, you know, you might be doing an orchestra rehearsal, you might be in a studio, but you also might be on a tour. So you might be kind of trapped in an environment where you're having to car share with somebody, and might even be asked to share a hotel room with somebody of the opposite sex. So it can be hard to escape in those environments. It's quite a trapped environment. And that makes it kind of difficult to report behaviour as well. You might be having to spend 2 weeks with these people. And of course, there's a pub culture that goes on in the music industry as well. So you might typically do a gig and then you go to the pub afterwards, and that's where some of the harassment can take place. So are you at work? Are you not? You know, again, who do you report it to? So that there are lots of challenges there that are quite specific to the music industry.
Okay. And so many of these things is like, it's hard to hear. It's not surprising, but it is hard to hear. And how would you say this impacts the industry as opposed to other professions that aren't having these issues?
I think it creates quite a culture of fear. And I think this is particularly because the nature of the industry, there are so many freelancers who are being employed. And I know that we're going to sort of perhaps talk about this a bit later in more detail. But, you know, if you're a freelancer, you're in quite an insecure work environment anyway. So, you know, you might well be afraid of reporting if you're a freelancer, because who knows if you get invited back. So I think it makes people really quite afraid.
Yeah, that is something that I have thought about for a long time, even in my own personal experiences. When you experience these things and not having someone to report to is the biggest challenge, I think. And are there any solutions to that? Because I've grappled with this as well. I'm like, what can be done? What can be done about this? And I can't think of anything.
You mean solutions to how people report? Or sort of changing that, yeah.
Yes, especially as a freelancer in a really defragmented industry where you're in, you know, private studios or something, that there aren't any structures in place.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And I think some of it is changing the culture. And I think that's where the larger organisations that can lead the way. And that's where things like codes of conduct can help, making sure that you're training your employees, making sure that you have a structure in place so that if you're employing freelancers, that they know who they could report incidents to. Yeah, so all those things, I think, would make a difference. But it is up to the organisations that have a more formal structure, because so much of the industry is informal, to lead the way.
Yes, definitely. And have there been any recent legal changes to address these sort of discriminatory behaviours? And are there any ways to improve this from a legal standpoint?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's a lot that could be done. And I would say, I mean, obviously I'm in the UK, so I'm speaking from that sort of legal framework, but I would say that the legislative framework in this country is just not up to the job at the moment. So what we have is the Equality Act that was introduced in 2010, and that did help to an extent, because it introduced some protected characteristics for people who are likely to be discriminated against. But the problem with that is that it only covers people who have, and I'm quoting here, a contract personally to do work. And you can imagine so much of the music industry, you haven't got a contract. You might be just rung, you know, your mobile phone might ring. You might be called by someone you've never spoken to in your life saying, could you just do, you know, dep on this Sunday for somebody? There's no contract. There's no nothing. So you're not covered by that act. So there was a little bit of progress just recently. Actually, we had the Worker Protection Bill went through Parliament. And that was designed to amend the Equality Act. So what it was trying to do, was introduce a new requirement for employers so that they have to take steps to prevent sexual harassment specifically happening in their own workplaces. So that means things like having clear policies, training your staff, and doing proper investigations if someone does report to you. And so that did pass, but unfortunately, it was also supposed to include a requirement to protect employees from third-party harassment, which, as you can imagine, is a big part of what goes on in the music industry. Well, we actually found in our report that over 25% of respondents had experienced third-party harassment. So that's from saying, a fan, an audience member, a member of the public, not one of your colleagues or somebody who's employing you. And that was in the bill, but it was taken out as it went through Parliament. So it's not been included. So that's a big area that there's still no protection for you for third-party harassment. So there's been a little bit of progress, but really not much. There's far more that could be done. So we know that the UK Parliament has a Women and Equalities Commission, and they're actually conducting a misogyny in music inquiry at the moment. And no doubt they will come up with quite a lot of recommendations that we will support for improving the situation, for particularly for sexual harassment in the industry. So we have to wait and see what they come up with and whether their recommendations are actually adopted. But what we're specifically calling for at the ISM is for the Equality Act to be amended so that everybody in the music sector is protected. So not just people who are employees, so people who are freelancers, people who are doing last minute depping, that kind of thing. We want to see third party harassment brought back into law, because it was in the original, I should say, the original Equality Act of 2010 did have third party harassment in it. And then it was taken out in 2013, so it was weakened. So we want to see that go back in. And we would also like to see proper funding of we have the Equality and Human Rights Commission in this country, and they are actually supposed to take up cases on behalf of people who have been discriminated against. But their funding has been frozen since 2012, so they have much less money to do anything to help people with. I mean, they obviously try, but we think that they should be properly funded, and that would, be an enormous help.
So is this a body that women that have experienced harassment in these sort of smaller work spaces, someone that they can report these things to?
Yeah, they can take up claims on people's behalf, yeah.
Right. I mean, does anyone know about this? I didn't even realise something like this existed.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, and now it's had its funding squeezed so much, it's less able to help, and it has less money to do that with. But we certainly let people know about it. And the other thing to say is obviously that the ISM, if you're a member of something like the ISM, then you can come to us as well for support if you're experiencing issues, bullying, harassment, that kind of thing, and that we have a legal team who can take up cases on members' behalf. So that there are avenues. It's definitely worth being a member of something like the ISM. I'm sure there are similar bodies in other countries. Yeah, I don't know how widely known it is that there is a proper body there that can help, and perhaps it is something that should be better publicised.
Yeah, I would say that I don't know if many of the musicians I know are aware of that, and I think that would be a great resource just to know that it's there for you if you need it. And speaking of reporting and bringing something like this to attention, whether it is to a body like ISM or even to a corporate body if you are working within a company, would you say that most incidences are reported? And if not, why do you think that is?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, a lot of it is the culture. So, I mean, we found there was a huge amount of non-reporting that went on. And people were saying to us, it's because it's part of the culture here. And they're literally those kind of quotes from people who responded to our survey, and or people feeling that even if they did complain, it wouldn't get them anywhere. They wouldn't be believed. Or in some cases, people were even told it's your own fault. One person said, "I was told you were a very attractive young lady," it's your fault. So it's almost like, you know, no one's going to actually listen if you do try to report it. But of course, a big problem is not having anybody to report the behaviour to. I think 75% of people overall said there wasn't anyone to report the behaviour to, but it's even higher if you're a freelancer. I think 95% of freelancers said there's no one to report it to. So what do you do? Yeah. But I think also the fear of losing work, as I mentioned earlier, is a big, big problem if you're a freelancer. If you're seen as a troublemaker, you may well not get invited back if you raise a problem. Of course, it's such a tightly connected industry. Everybody knows everybody else in the different areas. So the word could get around as well. Don't employ her, don't employ him, because, you know, they speak up if there's an incident. So it could absolutely devastate your career. And someone actually said the industry is so small, your life is over if you would say anything publicly. That's literally a quote that we got in from a respondent. So you can see the fear level there of destroying your own career if you were to dare to speak up about something.
Okay, so many factors there to address, and yeah, it's hard to know how to make that easier, other than, like you said, culture change, which is a big, big undertaking.
Yeah.
So how would you say that power dynamics within the music industry contributes to incidents such as these? And is there a way that we can address this?
Yeah. Power imbalances in the industry are absolutely, it's just rife with them, really. I mean, it starts in training. So we did a Dignity and Study report also in 2018, along with our first Dignity at Work one. And that was looking at what was going on in higher education. And we found there was a huge amount of discrimination there. And a lot of that is to do with the power imbalance between the student and the teacher. And that's also where it can get normalised and seen as acceptable. You sort of witness behaviour going on and nothing being done about it. Saying, well, this is how it is around here. And I think there's also an inherent power imbalance if you're young, you're an emerging artist in the industry, because you're really reliant on other people to hire you to do things. A lot of it's word of mouth. So you're dependent on people booking you, giving you opportunities. So promoters, fixers, they have a huge amount of power over other people's careers. So that's a massive power imbalance. And then you've also got figures, say, conductors, who are famously, you know, able to make or break careers. And there's also, sadly, a lot of gender inequality in the music industry. I mean, I think people might think it's sort of industry where there are a lot of women, and it's true, but they tend to be in the lower level roles. So we had a look at some studies, and for musicians in the industry, so 80% of signed artists are men, and 87% of headline acts at large music festivals are men. So it's sort of across the board that there are a lot of women in the industry, but they're not tending to make it to the top in the same way that the men are. So again, you've got this sort of power imbalance going on. And I think it is just too easy for people to get away with bad behaviour as well. There's a real lack of repercussions for the reasons that we've talked about. There not being structures in place, no method of reporting. So I think that's where we really do have to make changes to make sure that these power imbalances aren't impacting people in the way they are at the moment.
Are there any ways to do that?
Yes. Well, I think having codes of conduct is a good starting point. And we have our own that we developed with the Musicians Union in this country. And that definitely establishes a set of principles, basically, that aim to eradicate things like bullying and harassment. And it aims to do things like help employers understand and meet their legal obligations. And it also covers freelancers as well as employees. It tries to cover anybody who's employed in the sector. We have over 130 organisations in the UK have signed up to this code. And it is a good way to signal, I think, that, you know, that people who have signed this code, we understand this behaviour is unacceptable, and we are putting measures in place to change the culture and help stop it. And of course, there are other initiatives going on in this, similar ones in this space as well. I mean, I think there are challenges in implementing codes of conduct. They can only go so far. And I think there is a big problem with the sort of the informality of the way people are employed in the sector. It's a bit like the Wild West, I think, as I said before. You know, if you're a freelancer, you can get last minute bookings from complete randoms. You could be stepping in for somebody else at the last minute, no contract. But I do think, as I said before, that established organisations, so if you're a studio, you're an orchestra, you're a venue, you're a record label, you know, you can put a code of conduct in place and put those measures in. And because we all know each other in this industry, you start to understand that this is the right way to behave. So I think we do really, really do rely on, and also membership organisations like the ISM, we all have to lead the way and talk about it more as well, I think. That's why these reports are so important, because we're shedding a light on it now. I've also talked about what sort of the legislative slate change that could happen. But I think beyond a code of conduct, I think getting our house in order, it's not just signing up to a code of conduct. I think it is making sure that it can be a bit of lip service. So, you know, oh, we signed up to this code of conduct. That's lovely. But it's actually following through on that. And so one thing that we're doing is actually talking to the Equality and Human Rights Commission and some others in the sector about, say, looking at the orchestra sector, because there are a lot of orchestras, they employ a lot of musicians, and looking at whether there is something specifically that we could do in that space to make sure that orchestras are training all their staff, including freelancers. They have got procedures in place. You know, if you're booked to play with an orchestra, who you would go to report an incident, and ensuring that's clear to everybody who's coming in, even if they're really last minute, you know, coming in at the last minute replacement for somebody. So, yeah, I think there's definitely stuff going on that is going to improve matters, but it's making sure that everybody is trying to do something about it.
So for a large organisation that is looking to lead the way, what are the top recommendations that you would make for them?
I think, first of all, making sure you've got... So if you don't have an HR function, make sure there's somebody who has that responsibility in your organisation, and make sure they understand what the law is, what your responsibility is as an employer, and make sure you have some kind of a structure in place so that people who might experience bullying or harassment know who they can go to, what the process is, and that you're actually following up on it as well. So it's all very well having somebody who's reported to, but they need to actually then take action, take steps to make sure that the person who's, you know, being unacceptable in their behaviour is, you know, understands that this has to stop. So there are some kind of consequences. And we do have that in the ISM, you know, that we have our own code of conduct for our members, and we can remove people who are reported to us for bullying, harassment, that kind of thing. So it's making sure that there are some consequences in place, so it's not seen as an industry where you can just get away with stuff.
Yeah. Okay. And what about if you are in a small organization and you want to do the right thing, but maybe you don't have the ability to have a full-time HR function? What would you recommend for them?
I think, again, it's making clear to anybody that you're hiring, there are certain standards of behaviour that are not acceptable, and that action will be taken if you don't have to be an official HR person to understand that you can't behave like that. But I think it's a really good question, because, you know, we often think about, there are lots of, say, wedding bands out there, and they might be really small groups. And if something happens there, you need to have thought about what you do if your harpist or whatever comes and says, you know, a member of the audience has done this, you know, kind of, what are you going to do? I think having thought about it in advance. And that's where the organisations like the ISM can help as well. If you're a tiny organisation that you don't have an HR function, then it is worth having backup from somewhere else. You know, we have trained lawyers. We also have a helpline. Because I think the other thing that's important to say, that this kind of harassment and discrimination, it really does ruin lives. It doesn't just ruin careers. It ruins lives. It creates fear. It creates trauma. And, you know, we've had people coming to us in their 80s, you know, in response to our surveys, saying, you know, this happened to me when I was 19 and I've been living with the consequences ever since. So I think we can't overstate how devastating this kind of behaviour can be. and how important it is to really try and eradicate it.
So it's quite sad is the biggest understatement, I would say, to hear the findings of the report. But how do you feel about this going forward, Naomi? And given that your findings have worsened from the first report to the second report, do you feel optimistic, or how do you feel about the future of the industry?
I think it is, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is really depressing, and you can sometimes feel you're banging your head against a wall trying to get any change. But I think it is changing, and we had a really positive and productive roundtable discussion at the conference of the Association of British Orchestras earlier this year, where we talked about this issue in relation to orchestras specifically. And there was so much agreement in the room that we do need to do something. And I think the fact that we're talking about it and trying to put things in place, it is going to help, just raising awareness. I think it took a while. You know, the film industry had its Me Too movement. And I think music is beginning to have that now as well. You know, I think because there's been very low levels of reporting, the fact that we've done these surveys, and also people like the singer Rebecca Ferguson, you know, has really spoken out about the bullying that she has experienced, and feeling kind of trapped, even though she's a really successful musician herself. You know, the fact that she has experienced this, and it's sort of brave people like her speaking out, I think enable other people too. And I think the more that we do, the more we stop normalising this behaviour. But I think all we can do is try to talk about it more. I think education is really, really key. And that's why I think looking at what's going on in conservatoires and colleges and that kind of thing is also really important, and to talk about it there as well. Because if we can stop it being seen as normal, acceptable behaviour, then that's going to be going a long way to having procedures in place that stop or that deal with it, the behaviour when it comes up, and make it harder to get away with it.
Well, I have learned a lot from that, Naomi, and it's, as we said, not what I wanted to hear, but it's important to know, and it's important to speak about, and hopefully people that hear this episode understand that we're not banging on about something that isn't actually a problem, but just is so prevalent in the industry. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome. And I think, yes, the more we talk about it, the better. So thank you so much for inviting me on to discuss this really important subject.
Now, I guess just to lighten the mood, we are at our speed quiz time. So are you ready for that?
I am.
All right. So this is 5 quick fire this or that question, the first thing that pops into your mind. So cold weather or warm weather?
Warm weather.
Festival or rave?
Festival.
Animals or people?
Oh, that's a hard one. I'm going to go for people, but that's a really tough one.
Okay. Live DJ or live band?
Live band.
Melody or lyrics?
Melody.
Okay, that was pretty good. We caught you out on the animals or people. That one does get people sometimes. So, yeah, no, still very good, very good. Good job.
Thank you.
So coming to our top tips then, Naomi, can you tell me what is your one top career tip?
Well, obviously I'm not a musician myself, but I think something that applies to everybody is trying not to listen to your inner critic. I think we've all got that voice in our heads going, you're not good enough. But I think realising that everybody has got that inner voice. Everybody's got that imposter syndrome, or most of us anyway. And try not to listen to it, and go for those opportunities, and don't talk yourself out of it, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really good point. And I guess that's the difference between people that do the things they want to do and don't. Everyone's got that voice, but who listens, yeah, and gives into it?
Absolutely. So, I think it's a, yeah, kind of feel the fear, but do it anyway sort of approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. I love that. And what is your one top self-care tip?
I think this comes back to the running, actually. I think trying to do something physical every day. I mean, even if it's just a walk or it's just a kind of, you know, getting outside, I think is so important for our mental health and our physical health. So, yeah, just getting in that habit and not sitting in a chair, if you can, obviously.
Yeah. No, really good tip there. Obviously, a lot of our lives are made up of sitting in a chair. So how can we change that up? So that's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what is your one top general life tip?
I would say just try and get enough sleep. I think it's so easy to get in the habit of going to bed too late or, you know, trying to pack so much into our days. But I think what I've learned anyway, particularly as a mother and having broken sleep, that having a decent night's sleep makes all the difference to everything. Life is so much harder if you're tired and emotional and you can't cope. trying to get to bed at a sensible time and having a regular bedtime. It sounds really boring, doesn't it? But I think it makes a real, real difference.
Oh, sleep is so underrated. Enough sleep, not oversleeping, but
no, indeed.
You're very right there. And yes, cranky and emotional selves is not a good idea.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I love that. So thank you so much for that, Naomi. It's been really, really great to have you on the episode and great to hear all these insights of this really, really important study as well. And I look forward to it continuing and all the work that you're doing behind this in ISM. It's so, so important.
Thank you. Yes, we're very much continuing with it. So yeah, watch this space.
Excellent. Great to hear. Thank you. My biggest three takeaways from Naomi's episode was, firstly, it is much more likely for someone to suffer from discrimination if they are part of two or more groups that are being discriminated against, such as a Black female or a female that has a disability. My second biggest takeaway is that 87% of bands in the large music festivals are still made up of men, making this an area that still has a long way to go for quality. My last takeaway was that large organizations have a huge part to play in changing the culture of our industry because initiatives that they take on are likely to have a trickle-down effect into the rest of the industry. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.